This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A ban on greyhound racing, restoring the voting rights of former felons, ensuring sheriffs and clerks of the court remain elected positions. These are just a few of the constitutional amendments on your Florida ballot this November. Some of those amendments aren't so straightforward. A vote for one amendment ushers in a portmanteau of issues. So how well do you understand the amendments? Have you read the fine print? And do you know which you're voting yes for and which you'll vote no for and why? Join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can send us your questions and comments on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. With us in the studio, Dick Batchelor, former Democratic state lawmaker and founder of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Thanks for being here, Dick.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
Chris Carmody is an attorney with Gray Robinson and a Republican political analyst. Chris, thank you for joining us as well.
Good morning.
Let's start with the amendment that almost wasn't. This is Amendment 13 to ban greyhound racing. A lower court said that amendment was misleading and shouldn't be on the ballot, but the Florida Supreme Court ruled it back on the ballot, so voters will get to vote on it after all in November. Dick Batchelor, why is this issue so controversial?
Well, even in the legislature, Senator Gates at the time was proposing prohibiting greyhound racing. And because some people are just opposed to the way that dogs are run, mm-hmm. that they're actually used for this kind of a sport. And frankly, you see the particularly PETA and other organizations, they just outlaw greyhound racing altogether because of the way the animals are treated.
Mm-hmm. Is this the end of dog tracks in the state of Florida then, do you think?
I think so, but keep in mind, and Chris might have a better view on this as an attorney, but keep in mind, too, that in the legislation, they, years ago, allowed card games at tracks, too. Mm-hmm. So the question is the revenue coming for the greyhound racing, or is it coming from the card tables at the track? So greyhound racing itself, I think, doesn't survive, obviously, mm-hmm. but do they have some kind of a pari-mutuel wagering at the tracks?
Well, Chris Carmody, if you have some thoughts on that, I mean, is this the way these tracks actually stay afloat? Is it the other kinds of gambling that goes on rather than the betting on the dogs?
Yeah, you could argue that dog racing has been gone in Florida for a long time, except in name only. They certainly still run the dogs as they're required to if they're going to have those facilities. But Dick's right. The money maker for these are on the card rooms. Some of the online betting that they're able to do through the system, TV systems, but there's the dog racing group has a lobby shop, and they lobbied strongly in Tallahassee to block these measures when they were legislation. Mm-hmm. They worked against it when it was going through the CRC, which is where this amendment came from, and that was where this lawsuit came from. And it all comes down to this gets tied up into the big gambling question, which that's another question on the ballot for number three, but. Is how does Florida want to handle its gaming? Because dog racing is part of it. But Dick's right. The impetus on this was there's folks who just have a real hard time with allowing these dogs to race, and they want to shut it down. But the con of that is it kind of as you alluded to is you're effectively shutting down an entire industry by voting yes on this amendment. So people lose jobs, and it changes the complexion of our state's gaming system.
Right. So, I mean, is it as simple as saying if these dog tracks shut down, then everything that goes along with them kind of goes away as well? Or do you see those other gambling operations, you know, the legislature carving out a way for them to stick around elsewhere?
No, they'll stick around. Arguably, they'll become more profitable. They'll never probably admit it anywhere, but a lot of these card rooms, the dog tracks cost money, meaning they don't make money on it, but they have to run them if they're going to stay open as a card room under the way the state laws work. Mm-hmm. So if you're constitutionally prohibiting them, they will probably save money, never mind the fact that 3,000 employees estimated that work in the dog track industry that would lose their jobs in that realm. I'm sure they would find other means to take care of their family, but they would not be doing that anymore. But no, the card rooms, they'll make money. They'll make more money on this. Mm-hmm. But again, that adds to the complexion of gambling because some would argue that's an expansion of gambling by making it more profitable for these groups to run their card rooms by removing the requirement that they run dog tracks.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News, where with Chris Carmody and Dick Batchelor talking about the raft of constitutional amendments on the ballot. Maybe you've had a look at those amendments already and made your decision. There's 12 of them on there. Some of them are a bit complex. Some of them are fairly straightforward. We'd like to hear from you. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also reach out to us with your questions and comments on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. From the point of view of the voter, what does it look like when you stare at this long list of amendments? Do you understand everything that's on there, or do you have to do a little bit more research? I want to hear from you. 1-866-338-5252. Well, Chris Carmody, you were talking about Amendment 3. So the wording of this puts voters in charge of authorising casino gambling. How does this actually work? I'm not sure that I completely understand from reading the ballot what this would actually mean.
I think you said it pretty well. Essentially, right now, the legislature, the House and Senate, with the governor's approval, they control gaming in the state. And if this was to pass, any gaming decisions would now have to go through the Constitution. So now I've heard some folks say that it's retroactive. It would carve out some gaming, although I think that would be difficult. But prospectively, if, for example, sports betting, which is now based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision, some states are starting to do it outside of Nevada, Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. That would be something that, if this passed, would have to go through the Constitution as opposed to the state legislature. So it's more of a prospective look. So one way to look at it is, if you like the way the gaming structure in the state of Florida is today, and the only time you want to change it is with your vote, meaning you and the ballot box, then vote yes. If you don't like it and you want the legislature to amend it some, then I would say vote no. Or if you just would rather, with the whole Democratic government, if you would like your legislators to make those decisions and not the ballot box, then vote no. That's kind of what it boils down to. There's a few wrinkles in there, but that's largely where it's headed.
I'm just not sure, though, what it would mean in effect. Like, say, you know, it's all very well to say putting voters in charge of, for example, say a gambling operation wants to open a new casino. You put voters in charge, but does that mean you have to wait every, you know, 4 years or whatever for a constitutional amendment for that? Or
no, you could they could put it on the ballot whenever they wanted to. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, too, and Chris alluded to it earlier, gambling in Florida is a very complex, because you've got this proposed constitutional amendment, which basically is basically says if you are going to expand gambling, you have to do it by a referendum in the county. And this no casinos movement is being powered by several tens of millions of dollars, mm-hmm. most of which is coming from Walt Disney World.
Right.
Because Disney does not want gambling in Orange County. And then we could add to that, tangential but very important, is the agreement between the Seminole Tribe and the state of Florida, where they're supposed to be giving us well over $1 billion a year. So if you put all of that in, pari-mutuel gambling, dog tracks, no casinos, the Seminole Tribe agreement, and
This is too much to put on an amendment, really, isn't it?
You know, the point is, and the listeners really do need to go ahead and get their sample ballot and look at this. And the Orlando Sentinel did print it, all the proposed constitutional amendments, and really dive into them. Don't wait to get to the ballot box, because if mm-hmm. you wait to get to the ballot box, you face maybe 11 proposed constitutional amendments. A lot of people are just going to shake their heads and walk out. They'll never vote on them. So I encourage people not only to listen to what we're saying, but also get a copy of the sample ballot.
We're at 1-866-338-5252. Love to hear your questions and comments about the constitutional amendments. Some of the big ones up for debate are a potential ban on greyhound racing, restoring the voting rights of former felons in the state of Florida, and ensuring that positions like sheriff and other constitutional officers remain elected positions. Love to hear your thoughts on those amendments, whether you've already decided what you're voting on, whether you want some more information, and how you're going about getting that information. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. Matt, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I just want to say I'll definitely be voting yes on 13. I just think it's pretty obvious the way these animals are treated. It just needs to stop. I mean, it's a relic of the past, and I just think it needs to end. It's way past time, doesn't make any money, and it's just cruel in general.
Let me ask you this, Matt, because one thing you'll hear from advocates of greyhound racing is, you know, they'll say, well, look, people who oppose it, have they ever been to a dog track, and have they seen how the animals are treated? So let me ask you that. Have you been to a dog track? Have you seen the way the animals are treated?
I have. There's actually a history of dog racing on my wife's side of the family. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I know how it is. I will never go back. Mm-hmm. And it's just the relic of the past, like I said, and it's cruel and it just needs to end. You see all these dogs dying all the time. They're testing positive for drugs. I mean, just got to stop.
Matt, thanks for weighing in. Appreciate your call on that issue there. And I guess that's kind of a slice of some of the sentiment we're hearing on that issue, Dick Batchelor. I want to move on, though, to talk about felons' voting rights restoration. This has got a lot of attention this year. What will Amendment 4 do to put those rights back for former felons, Dick Batchelor?
Well, basically, under this current administration, the Scott administration, if you want to have your voting rights restored, you go through, I think, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, a clemency board of sorts, and they can make a decision. But this would all basically say, of course, it exempts certain crimes. If you're convicted of murder or things like that, aggravated assault, you wouldn't be covered. But basically saying if you've served your time, you automatically get your voting rights back in the state. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing, it's kind of been under the radar, but it's very popular and really did not come through the CRC. So there's a lot of support for it. So, but it basically restores felons' voting rights. If would those exemptions of heinous crimes, obviously they would not be covered.
Chris Carmody, there's kind of a bunch of caveats in this amendment and the wording on the ballot, at least, about the cost of implementation of restoring these voting rights. Why is it important to include that on this amendment, do you think?
Well, some of that is constitutionally required to put the cost of it. If you recall the amendments in the 90s that were going to ask for bullet trains through the state of Florida, one cycle it passed on the ballot.
Wait a minute. Bullet trains, you mean like high speed rail, like sort of the kind of Shinkansen you have in Japan?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That was in our constitution, then it wasn't. And one of the reasons now, and I'm trying to remember the year when it was passed on the constitution, but there was then a provision added in that said, if you're going to have these amendments, you have to say how much they cost.
Mm-hmm.
Because the argument was, for those who were against the bullet train, was that Floridians were going to vote yes. Same with the teachers in schools, but the ratio about people didn't understand the cost that was involved. They would vote yes, not knowing it would cost the state $1 billion or $2 billion, what have you. So that's why it's required. But I think it's good, helpful information. I think that's been one of the more positive changes in the constitutional amendment process is we should know as voters, especially those who are willing to dig into the facts, we should know what we're getting into. Now, with the felons' rights, that I don't think that's going to detract from anyone of any costs associated with it. I think, as Dick was alluding to, it's a popular issue. You have the Koch brothers, who are ultra-conservative, coming out in favor of this.
Which is pretty unusual, right? I mean, put that in context for a moment, because on one side of the argument, you have folks saying, look, if you're a former felon, you really have to work to prove that you're an upright citizen and you are worthy of getting your vote back. And then folks who are saying, look, this is not fair, it takes too long. But if you have people like the Koch brothers supporting it, that kind of tells you how the winds are changing on this issue.
Most definitely. I mean, it's to be clear, it's not as if you walk out of prison and all your rights are back. You mentioned there's some caveats in there. There's still a process. It's just, it's not the long process that it is now. And as Dick said, under this current administration, the clemency board procedures have been, while not explicitly required, essentially that's what's been required, a de facto extra step. So those who don't like that, this will be their opportunity to vote and change that system. But it won't be automatic, but it will be a much better system than we have now if you're someone that says, yes, I want felons to have these rights restored.
Mm-hmm. Could I go back to one that you went over very briefly, and that is the one on you cannot require that local elected officials be appointed,
Yep. Basically.
That's important because, keep in mind, that case, there's a case here in Orange County where the constitutional office, the charter amendment made them try to make them nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously they want to remain partisan. That case is going to the Florida Supreme Court, it looks like. So they're kind of a somewhat related issue there as far as electing versus appointing constitutional officer, even if you have a charter county.
Yeah, and this is Amendment 10. So this is kind of one of the more complex amendments because the sort of headline of this is that if you vote yes on Amendment 10, you are ensuring that sheriffs, property appraisers, supervisors of elections, tax collectors, clerks of courts in all counties remain elected positions. So in some cases, you know, the county charters, this could be an appointed position. Obviously, the Sheriff's Association, we've seen a lot of publicity from them saying this is very important. We need to make sure that sheriffs remain elected positions. Mm-hmm. But there's a bunch of other things in here too. This amendment would also create an Office of Domestic Security and Counterterrorism mm-hmm. within the Department of Law Enforcement. It would change the annual legislative session commencement date and even numbered years from March to January.
Those are related issues, aren't they?
It would also require legislature to retain Department of Veterans Affairs. So there's a bunch of things kind of jammed in here. Is that confusing to you, Dick Batchelor? Because it's a little confusing to me.
It is, and I think it's intentional. I think the Constitutional Revision Commission basically tried to bundle maybe what I would see as a negative proposed constitutional amendment with two attractive ones, but you as a voter don't have the chance. You can vote for the one you like, but tangentially you get two maybe you don't particularly like, and trying to make them germane is interesting. But I think a lot of it's intentional. And here's an overarching question, and Chris, you're an attorney. You can respond to this probably. How many of these proposed constitutional amendments could have been done by statute and not cluttered up the Constitution?
Chris, you want to...
A great number of them could be done by statute.
You want to tackle that, Chris? Well,
yeah, sure. And I would say, real quickly on Amendment 10, that what's interesting on that, and this is Dick's right, voters should absolutely go look at these amendments. That one was drawn from Miami-Dade, who has an appointed sheriff. And there's people in Miami-Dade, some of which who want to run for sheriff, who didn't like that. And that
right.
was a legislative effort for multiple years. There's been, I think, at least three legislative efforts to put a constitutional amendment forward. Because of the way Miami-Dade's structure is, they're covered by the Constitution. So if you want to make any changes to the sheriff or any other constitutional officer, you can't do it locally like we've seen here in Orange County and others in Central Florida. You actually have to go through the state constitution. So that effort was multiple years. It kept getting defeated because here's the truth. It had a lot of maybe intended, but I think unintended effects. It affected Volusia County. They have an elected sheriff mm-hmm. who's actually technically an employee of the county. They also have a couple other constitutional officers like that. Duval County, Hillsborough County were going to be affected by it. And as Dick alluded to, there's those Orange County measures that are going all the way up to the Supreme Court on partisan, nonpartisan that would be affected. So it's, that one, it has some far more reaching effects than just as simple as, oh, well, you know, it'd be nice if they're all elected. Because mm-hmm. Basically, except for the Miami-Dade sheriff, they are all elected, but some of them have different varying powers. Broward is going to be affected by that as well. They're one of those counties that have different provisions on how they deal with their constitutional officers.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't in the original intent, but they are certainly going to be wrapped up into that. But going to Amendment 6, I would go with on these laws that are becoming, it's called Marcy's Law.
Mm-hmm.
And I've looked at this. It's the victims' rights for those in the judicial process.
Yep.
It has a lot of merit, but again, it's called Marcy's Law, and I think that's notable. A lot of these probably could be laws and not constitutional amendments. You can go all the way back down the ballot language to Amendment 12, which deals with lobbying and abuse of public office.
Sure.
Right.
This was a priority of previous President Gates for multiple sessions. And it's, you know, some of the provisions are kind of onerous, a whole 6-year ban on lobbying if you're an elected official. And if, so for example, if one of our city or county commissioners wanted to lobby in Tallahassee, this would prohibit that if they were a sitting county or city commissioner and still restrict them from lobbying their own city
mm-hmm.
6 years after leaving office. Some people like that, but most say, hey, the citizens need to vote for who they want to and no one should be denied the right to go make a living. But this was a law that just never could get to the finish line when President Gates was in office. He was a Constitutional Revision Commission member, and he did a good job negotiating getting it on the ballot.
I want to just get a phone call. I want to just get a phone call in here, if I may, Chris. We've got Denise on the line. Denise, I believe you have a thought about Amendment 10.
Yes, sir. I think elected or appointed, I'm not in favor of one of the other, but with the elected, I'm very opposed to the campaign funds that are coming from publicly traded prison corporations that are going to sheriffs, district attorneys, judges, et cetera, who now own stock and they have the lockup quotas. And it's just very contraindicated in my world.
Mm-hmm. Denise, thanks for your call. Dick Batcher, I wonder if you want to weigh in on that one.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. The private prison industry, and there are two or three in Florida, nationwide firms, publicly held firms, that are running prisons. Is it a big debate now about whether or not that's a good thing? Are they doing a good job? Do we do a better job if the Department of Corrections is run by itself and not contracting out the prison? So there is a debate. And lastly, I think the lady alluded to it, is there undue influence on those companies that provide those services by making contributions to candidates, including judges?
Yes, interesting thoughts there. I just want to get a couple of thoughts in from our listeners reaching out to us on Twitter. Holly writes in Amendment 5. Now, Amendment 5 concerns taxation. It would require a supermajority vote to require to authorize or raise state taxes or fees. And there are a couple of kind of tax-related amendments there, but this is one in particular. Holly writes, Amendment 5 will unnecessarily restrict response to future recessions, natural disasters, and threatens our AAA bond rating. Just look at Oklahoma and Arizona. Dick Batchelor, real quick, thoughts on that? I mean, is this potentially hamstringing Florida's ability to raise money in the future?
Absolutely. It's the legislature telling themselves they shouldn't be doing what they don't want to do. I mean, it's very confusing. It could be in a statute. Each session, the legislature adopts those $87 billion budget. If they decide to increase revenue, they can do it by a simple majority vote. This proposed constitutional amendment, I think, unduly hamstrings future legislatures.
Chris Carmody, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think if for Central Floridians, there's going to be two amendments that we care about the most. We already covered Amendment 3. That's the gambling one. If you like our theme park industry, I would say support that because we've got a good brand here and go with it. But Amendment 5, it's taxes are one thing. And what she said about AAA bond ratings, not wrong. But I even go deeper. Look at UCF. If UCF is going to continue to grow as a nationally recognized university, there will come a time where it will need to increase its tuition. Under the way this amendment works, this legislature would not be able to increase their tuition, which is considered a fee, a matriculation fee, unless they got that supermajority. Mm-hmm. So maybe they could get it one day in the future, but we can all see that day coming. And I think for something like this, I would not want to tie the hands of our legislators and say they can't do what they think is right, whether it's for our university system or for someone else. This Republican can't believe he's going to vote against a tax supermajority. But
we won't tell anybody.
The picture. Yeah, thank you. Don't tell anyone. Is this live? But the the problem is it's far and wide its reach. And when it says the word fees, that covers a whole lot of things there, including state tuition. Which credit to Governor Scott for keeping the universities and the legislature from raising it for 8 years because it had gotten out of hand. Mm-hmm. But there will absolutely come a day where someone's going to have to say, well, if we want to seriously compete with the other major universities in the country, we need to be able to raise some tuition. Mm-hmm. And under this, they wouldn't be able to do that unless they can get that supermajority vote.
So one final thought from another listener. Mabel writes, in constitutional amendments feel like legislators are not doing their job. Why are we changing a constitution by so many things? Kind of a key question here, Dan. I know you, Dick Batchelor, I know you have some thoughts on this, but we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you for listening. Thank you for writing with your questions and comments. We'll tackle this issue again before the election. Dick Batchelor, former state legislator and founder of the Dick Batchelor Management Group, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Carmody, attorney with Gray Robinson and Republican political analyst. Chris, thank you as well.
Read those ballots early, folks. Thanks for having me.
Still to come, a conversation with Nina Strike, the executive director of the Global Peace Film Festival and former New York City Film Commissioner. Intersection is back in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. The Global Peace Film Festival kicked off this week and it runs through the weekend. Films include a locally produced feature about the first integrated Little League game in the South and a film that offers a glimpse of everyday life in North Korea. The festival also includes live music, photography and a chance to meet both the filmmakers and subjects of some of the films. Nina Strike is the Executive Director of the Global Peace Film Festival. Welcome to Intersection.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
It's a pretty substantial program for the film festival this year. Has it grown in size over the years?
Well, actually, it's less films than we had in the past because we wanted to focus more on specific films. So we've concentrated more, but the festival itself has grown and we get more people at every film as opposed to more films with less people.
Mm-hmm. What stands out for you? What are you excited about showing the audiences here in Orlando?
Well, I'm excited about the whole program, of course, but we have so many wonderful films, and what really excites me is the films that we have filmmakers joining us, and also some of the films we have subjects of the films joining us as well.
Mm-hmm.
So audience really has an opportunity to interact with not just the people who made the film, but in some cases, the people who are doing the things that the films are about. So it gives a much more robust experience.
Do you get a lot of student filmmakers in the audience for these Q&As?
We're less of a filmmaker film festival than we are a audience engagement film festival, which excites me because what a lot of the filmmakers who've been here with their films tell us is this is the only film festival that I've been to that everybody wants to know about what's happening with the subject, what's happening with the issue, rather than what camera I used or how much mm-hmm. the budget was. Those are questions we don't often get because we want to, you know, our tagline is it starts here. We want the showing of the film at the festival to be the beginning of a discussion and the inspiration for somebody in the audience or more than one person in the audience to do something about what they've seen and heard.
So the film festival goes beyond mere films, not that they're mere films, of course, but there's more to it than that, right? And you have some kind of corresponding exhibits. Tell me about Peter Morey. He was the official photographer for Nelson Mandela.
In the last years of his life, yeah. Mm. Fascinating man. And at the City Arts Factory, the exhibit will be there through October 12th.
Mm-hmm.
And 40 of his photographs of Mandela at different times of his life, starting with his inauguration, ending with very personal family photos, will be on display at City Arts Factory. Very excited about that. And Peter is with us. He's here through the weekend. Hopefully people will be able to get to see him and meet him.
The fact that it's the Global Peace Film Festival, you have a pretty specific focus, right? So how do you go about curating movies for it? How does that process work?
Well, as much as it's a specific focus in the name, since the festival started, I've always believed that peace is much more than just War and Peace. And one of my favorite reviews of the festival paraphrased Robin Williams and said, if you think you know what you're going to see, you haven't been there. We look to find films that are engaging, that are educational, but are also good films that'll inspire people, that'll give people a different perspective. So global peace is just a framework, and there's so much that falls into it. It's not just about peace. It's about sustainability. It's about justice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much more wide-ranging than just the title implies. And one of the reasons to call it global peace is it's really important for people to recognize that every single one of us aspires to peace in some way. We may aspire to peace in a different way than each other, but peace is something that we should all embrace. It's for everybody. It starts within each and every one of us, and we have to find our own path to peace, whether it's just in our own family or in our community or in the country or globally.
I mean, has the film festival changed significantly since it started, though?
Yes, in that we're much more focused on partnering with community organizations who are working on the issues so that there's a real collaboration between us as the festival, the films that we bring to the festival, and the organizations that are working on those issues. To me, success of the festival is that the organizations that we partner with are able to build capacity through partnering with us and coming and speaking at the films that we show.
How did you get into this? I mean, this is a pretty specific sort of line of work.
I was the New York City Film Commissioner in the early 90s. I worked for David Dinkins in his mm-hmm. administration. And when I left the administration, I sort of fell into doing a film festival as a development director. And one film fest, that film festival started coming to me, you know, hey, can you join us? And I never anticipated the first film festival I went to. I was like, oh, this is like a cliquey group of people and, you know, not for me. And now it's, you know, my career, basically. I mean, I'm producing a film myself completely separately from the festival. It's actually about David Dinkins, the mayor of New York, the only black mayor of New York so far, who was mayor from 90 to 94. But it wasn't an expected career choice, but it's something that I've fallen in love with. And in terms of Global Peace Film Festival, which I created, I was hired to create it, in fact, it marries my two loves, which is, you know, social activism, politics, and film. I was in the film office when Bonfire of the Vanities was filmed. Among the other crazy things that happened in production was the Bronx Borough president wanted the filmmakers to change the script to have a more positive view of the Bronx. And when this kind of blew up, which was, of course, a Friday night, Mayor Dinkins got involved because I had to call him, you know, and say, hey, something's going on. And immediately he said, nope, this is a First Amendment issue. I'm going to take care of it. No way is the Bronx Borough president going to prevail on this. In fact, a lot of the films that I worked on in the film commission, they would say, here, read the script. We want you to read the script. But after a few films, I was like, you know, I'd rather not read the script until after you're done, because I want to advocate for you as strongly as possible. And if I don't like your script, it's going to impact how aggressively I fight for you.
Mm-hmm. So as film commissioner, your job is more about
It's two things. Marketing the city that you work in, attracting film the business to your city, and then cutting red tape so that filmmakers are able to get what they need as quickly, efficiently, and effectively as possible.
Would you want to do that job now in the 21st century?
It was bad enough because I would get calls at 4 a.m. when something was going on a set. Now you're really 24/7. And I had the opportunity. Bill de Blasio, the current mayor of New York City, was an aide in the Dinkins administration. I've known him since the late 80s, in fact, and had an opportunity to maybe go back into the office. And I'm like, there's no minute that you'd get any time off. I mean, we had one instance where somebody wanted to explode a helicopter right on a bridge. And, you know, you never want to say no. You want the filmmakers to know that they, you know, that you're going to fight for them and work for them to get everything that they need. But the Department of Transportation said, well, if they do that, they're going to buckle the bridge.
So they didn't get to do it?
Actually, what I did is, obviously the bridge was over a body of water. Mm-hmm. And what I did is this is a real challenge. Let's see how we can do this. Well, you need to bring the Coast Guard in, and you need to bring this in, and this is what you need to do. And eventually I was like, got so complex that that they were like, we're going to think of something else.
I guess these days, though, with CGI, you probably wouldn't even need to necessarily kind of jump through all those hoops.
I know. And that was some of the fun. Some of the really big stuff was the challenging stuff. Is like, how are they going to do that? Like a film I totally love that was shot in New York when I was there is The Fisher King. And the horse, if people know this part of the film, the horse that's Robin Williams' vision is actually a live-action horse. And one of the issues was they wanted the horse to breathe fire, but the ASPCA wouldn't allow that, of course. And they had to put a rider on top and have the fire breathe out of the rider's helmet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's like all kinds of negotiation that's kind of fun.
So what are you looking forward to this weekend? What are the standouts?
Well, a local film that I want to mention, which is playing on Saturday night at 7:30 in the Bush Auditorium at Rollins College, is Long Time Coming, a 1955 baseball story, which is about one of the first integrated Little League games in the South. And the filmmakers are local, and some of the players are local. And I know at least a couple are coming, but we don't know exactly who. So looking forward to that. The filmmaker from Playing Frisbee in North Korea is coming, and there's a lot of information in that film, but what to me stands out is that you don't often see people, and ordinary people in North Korea, and not just in Pyongyang, but sort of in the countryside.
That's because it's pretty hard for filmmakers so she to was, get in there, I
and assume. So she's coming. The filmmaker is coming, and the reason she was able to do this was that she was a Colin Powell fellow, and this was a trip that she got in while she was doing that fellowship. So it's an interesting and different and unusual look into North Korea.
Are you already thinking about next year's film festival?
Yes. The festival itself is our best marketing for people to get involved going forward. So we start thinking about it, sort of the marketing end of it rather than the creative end of it starts now. Always looking for films, always looking for ideas.
Nina Stryker is the executive director of the Global Peace Film Festival. It runs through the end of this weekend. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Global Peace Film Festival takes place at Rollins College and the Winter Park Library. More details on our website, wmfe.org. Still to come, a performance from Amy Robbins and Galen Amundsen from the band Maple Sparrow. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Joining us in the studio are Amy Robbins of the band Maple Sparrow and Galen Amundsen. Amy on guitar and vocals, and Galen, banjo, vocals and fiddle, will perform this Saturday at a book launch for Burrow Press's book Worm Fiddling Nocturne and the Key of a Broken Heart. That's at a retail space in Orlando's SoDo Shopping Centre. Here they are now with a song called The Worries.
Yeah, I thought that we would beat it. You took me to outer space, showed me the energy rings, promised me the galaxy, said I'd be your everything. You stayed so sad, while the weight of the world was a feather on my back. Time after time, dwelling on troubles in your mind, you never see the worries that are mine. If I was a smarter girl, maybe I'd leave, go and study medicine, cure some bad diseases, move to the ocean side. No vows are left to keep. Still hate to admit defeat. You stayed so sad, while the weight of the world was a feather on my back. Time after time, dwelling on troubles in your mind, you never see the worries that are mine. Troubles weighing on your mind. make a right.
Hi, I'm Amy Robbins.
I'm Galen Amundsen.
Maple Sparrow is my project. It kind of started as a stage name and turned into a band or whatever other entity I play under for it.
Where does the name come from?
It's actually kind of funny. When my husband and I moved into our house in Howie in the Hills, Florida, which was a family home for him, his grandmother had left some things around the house, and I was cleaning out one of the closets, and this little wooden bird fell out. And I said, oh, it's a maple sparrow. Look how cute that is. And we looked at each other. I was like, that's a stage name. And it kind of just stuck from there.
So what's the bluegrass scene like here in Orlando, Central Florida? Galen?
It's good. I learned old time here and then went kind of to DeLand area for some bluegrass when I was little. It's good because there's a jam at Orlando Brewing, and my first fiddle teacher inspiration is in town. And now I'm teaching Amy some old-time guitar, so it's making it much easier to stay in town when you have people that want to play the bluegrass and stuff.
Did you start out as a bluegrass musician, Amy?
No. I like bluegrass. I've always listened to bluegrass and been to a couple jams and stuff, but I would never have called myself a bluegrass player. Kind of got started on like old country type of stuff and learned a bunch of like 90s pop covers and stuff like that to play in bars to get me started. And I started writing music, and I like to think it's kind of a, I call it Americana, kind of bluegrass, country, blues, fusion type of thing I do.
What about yourself, Galen? Do you have some country roots as well?
I guess I mostly have music roots. My grandma was a piano teacher. My mom is a painter. And I just got a fiddle when I was little and went from there. And we traveled around quite a bit. So I got out of Florida, I guess, in 2009. And started going to other festivals and realized there was just this whole new world of music. And now I try to take it back here. And happily, it's just being so accepted this year. So I'm happy to like carry on that bluegrass torch in Orlando.
Mm-hmm. Is there a continuum of musicians who've been playing bluegrass for decades?
Definitely.
Or is there a revival where people are just discovering it for the first time?
Oh, in our town here? I would say first timers. I haven't found so much of like the tradition that, because I do miss that when I'm here. I miss the tradition and the family legacies that are in Virginia or whatnot. But it's still all there for us, and now we're starting our own legacy.
Amy Robbins, do you have some other instruments up your sleeve as well?
I play bass some also. Started on the mountain dulcimer.
Me too.
Is that something you lay on your lap to play?
Yes, it's a lap instrument. It's got four strings. One of them's a double string.
Oh, the high string. Fancy.
Yeah. You can play it with a slide or you can chord it. And it's pretty basic, easy to learn on.
We do. I used to go to the jams out in Longwood at the library on dulcimer jams. Like starting.
Do they
out.
Still have them?
I don't think so.
So, well, that's just a bunch of musicians all with dulcimers?
Yes, a very big library room full.
They make a lot of noise, a dulcimer?
It's pretty loud, yeah.
Together they make quite a rumble, but they sound good together.
Yeah.
It's all in D, mostly, the key of D.
Yeah.
And there's books, tab books. I still have mine.
Amy, I probably do, too.
We could start a dulcimer jam.
We should.
So tell me about the event this weekend.
Yes, this weekend, Saturday, September 22nd, we are playing a book release called, in the book I think it's called Worm Fiddling Nocturne in the Key of a Broken Heart. And it's by Kimberly Lajewski. It's a series of 12 short stories. And I don't know exactly what they're about, but from what I've read, it's like type of mythical type of stuff, like your friend's vampire, whatever.
Witch,
yeah. So I'm really excited to get my hands on that.
Well, Amy Robbins and Galen Amundsen, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
This is a song called Boy Blue. 1, 2, 3, 4. Single girl, I wanna be. You should.
6-year-old boy as he sat on a cold curb in L.A. And then he said, somehow, some way, it'll all work out sometime, someday. Somehow, some way, it'll all work out sometime, someday. Angels have their wings and children have their dreams, and I've got nothing at all. Pillow has a bed and a clock has its wall, and I've got nothing at all. Until I said somehow, some way, it'll all work out sometime, someday.
And that's Galen Amundsen and Amy Robbins with a track called Boy Blue. They're performing this Saturday at a book launch for Burrow Press at Orlando Soto Shopping Centre. And over on our website, wmfe.org/intersection, you can hear a bonus track, Someone Like You. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. You can download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're on the NPR One app as well. I'm Matthew Petty. Join us next Tuesday for a conversation with Orlando Sentinel photographer Red Huber. And thanks for listening.